The first time we visited Alpha Omega, they were in the middle of building a brand new tasting room in the town of Rutherford, in the heart of Napa Valley. By harvest time, the new room was completed and welcoming guests. Jean Effier is winemaker at Alpha Omega, and he was kind enough to give me a lesson in proper pronunciation of his name.
Jean Effier is very easy. You know, good luck pronouncing that.
Jean Effier.
Almost Jean Effier.
I interviewed Jean during the harvest of 2008 on the front lawn of the winery where, around the corner, workers were hand-sorting beautiful Cabernet grapes. Jean, tell me where you're from and what got you into wine.
I was born in Lausanne, Switzerland, which is the western part of Switzerland, the French-speaking part, from an American mother and a Swiss father. I started actually in law school there and went through 2 years of law school and suddenly woke up and decided to do something better to me. And so I went into wealth management. And after a year and a half, I was spending 100% of my salary in wine. So I decided that doesn't really sound logical, and I really enjoy and looking forward to tasting wine. Why am I doing wealth management? So I decided to go knock on my godfather's door, who owns a winery in Switzerland, and did an internship as a cellar worker there, and really enjoyed the contact with wine and the balance between science and art. In the sense that you have lab, you run tests, but for me, it all comes back to taste, to emotion. I always say my biggest goal in my wines is to create an emotion in people. So I actually decided from then on to travel in order to learn a little bit more than just Swiss wine. Went to California. I worked at Michel Schlumberger for a while, Hartford Court, as a night cellar master. Then I went to Bordeaux at Chateau Carbonieu and Mirlis down in South Africa. And at that time, I had enough field experience to really get a touch and a feel of what I was supposed to do. I lacked of true knowledge and theoretical knowledge. So I've decided to go to winemaking school and in Switzerland. And I went through my viticulture and winemaking degree over there and passed it and enjoyed it a lot. And after that, I went back and worked at Lynchbach in Bordeaux again during the 2000-2001 year. And I was kind of limited in the type of expression I wanted to have in wine. And the reason for that is in Europe, in most countries, and definitely in France, winemaking is regulated by a lot of different laws and traditions that, to me, limits your ability and capacity to create something that you want and the best product, best wine that you want. So, I mean, I always say for me, it's kind of giving Picasso half of the color to paint a masterpiece. What's the point, you know? So I decided to come back here where regulations are in place, but it's always in order to maximize the client, the customers, and the drinker's safety or the quality of the wine. So I came back in 2001, at Harvest 2001, and started being the winemaker up at Newton, where I stayed for 5 years. And during that process, was approached by the two managing partners here, Eric Sklar and Robin Baggett, to start that, you know, the Alpha Omega project. They knocked on my door one day and said, "Oh, you've been making wine quite successfully up there for a while. We would like to know if you would like to join that new project." And of course, it's interesting. What volume are we looking at? 8,000-10,000 cases, very limited. Like, oh, that sounds interesting. Where's that project? Well, I'm not going to tell you really where it is. I'm going to show it. So let's meet, you know, on Wednesday. Okay. And I came here in this winery that formerly was Quail Ridge, Esquisse, Domaine Napa to start with in 85, and saw that and got really afraid, because nothing in this entire building or vineyard was up to the standards of quality wine I wanted to produce.
So what did you call it back then?
The Super Dome. I mean, it was just not the type of environment I wanted. So I said, no, I'm sorry, I'm not gonna join your project. And they came back to me and said, okay, if we guarantee you in your contract that you don't have any limits on winemaking, viticulture, or whatever touches quality of the product, would you accept? And I said, yeah, I would probably. So they said, okay, deal, you have no limitation. So the first thing I started to do is making wine for them off premise. And while searching for different vineyards, I went and knocked on a couple of doors and, you know, tried to meet people that I knew had great vineyard that would really express what I was looking for, and actually ended up having vineyards in every single appellation of Napa Valley. The reason why is that I believe that wine benefits like society from diversity. And by having all these different profiles of wine or vineyard, soils, climate, when you make them separately and understand their personality, when you sit down to blend them, you have just more possibilities and more different type of wine. And that philosophy is translated all the way to the winemaking, in the sense that I go in every single one of these vineyards at least once a week. Closer to harvest, it's 3 or 4 times a week, to taste, to measure, to understand how they react to climatic changes, to different vintages. And when they come and they're picked in these yellow boxes, very small, very protected, they're sorted to the berry and they go in the tank or the barrel. I have to adapt to their personality and not the opposite. My philosophy is, if I adapt myself to the wine and to the grapes and to nature, I will be able to maximize the potential in a much easier way. And that was really, you know, the philosophy that I tried to start with the owners when we first started. I said, okay, I have carte blanche, that's perfect, but it's gonna cost you. And so we started having vineyards, Toquelon, Stagecoach, Newton, Hudson down in Carneros and stuff like that, no problem. Started renovating this building, make it up to standards, ordering new material, sorting tables, new tanks, and they started bills, just seeing bills come in, and not inexpensive bills. Up to today, I've never been denied one penny for anything that touches production. Everything within these boundaries, I can have. It really kind of made me feel good and really let me want to jump in that project, because for me it was freedom of expression. Just like a writer, press, a painter, go ahead. You have all the tools you want. Express yourself the way you want. And for me, it was a real blessing to be able to encounter this type of philosophy, I have to say. That's why I'm still here, and that's why, you know, 14, 15 hour per day for 4 months, because of course, when you do these type of wines, naturally fermented wines, fermentation lasts for much longer. And it's also the time of the year where the relationship between the grape and the wine and me starts. It's a dialogue. It's a day-to-day dialogue from the vineyard. I'm not ready, you know, I still want to stay out there. I'm still a little green, a little edgy and stuff like that. To the final product, hopefully, if I do my job right at understanding the profile and the personality of the wine, where it says, okay, now I'm smooth, I've matured, I've balanced and stuff like that. It's ready to go to barrel and age there. So I always compare a lot that process with life, with relationship with people, with respect with people. I respect the grapes. I try to respect the grapes, and hopefully they'll respect me. If they don't, then we're going to start having problems.
John, what's your approach to winemaking?
Most companies, they apply the same recipe to whatever grapes they get and whatever year. For me, wine is made 90% in the vineyard. Therefore, it's to us to understand what nature is telling winemakers, from the vineyard all the way to the tank. Vineyard, okay, understand a vine. A vine, if it carries 50 pounds of grapes, is gonna struggle. It's not gonna maximize its own potential. If you put 50 pounds on my back and tell me to go climb Mount St. Helena, it's gonna be definitely harder than without 50 pounds. It's the same principle on any vine, I think. So for me, that balance is really, really important. And I try to protect that character, that individuality in their personality, all the way to the end product, in the sense that I do naturally fermented wines, I do unfine and unfiltered wines, to respect these differences, to respect what nature is bringing me. Why would I add yeast when it's already provided by nature? Probably at a higher diversity. There's more different type of yeast on a single berry outside in the vineyard than if you inoculate with an industrial strain of yeast, which gives you one strain of yeast. Well, I like, once again, the diversity and the complexity. That's my thing. And why would you have to readjust later in your process by fining if you taste the way I do every day, every lot, to adapt the extraction and the winemaking process to the wine and not the opposite?
Considering you've been able to make use of many resources, the bottom line is the whole process can scare the heck out of you.
Of course. I mean, there's a lot of things that I think you learn in wine over the years. You know, making wine, you have one shot per year. It's not a lot. One shot per year at something is not, you know, you, a lifetime of this is probably, for me, I'm 35, another, you know, 40 times if I'm lucky. That's 40 times. It's not a lot. To readjust what you want. So yes, it is very scary. And the type of philosophy that I have by, you know, doing these naturally fermented is definitely more risky as well. You know, you have more risk. It's, you don't have a lot of safety nets and stuff like that. But what does it translate to? The love of what you do. By going and tasting the wine through the entire process on a daily basis, you control it. You control that the emotion that this wine creates within you is in boundaries of what you want. And if it doesn't, well, you have tools to hopefully change that and put it back in the right way. It is risky, no doubt. The more you learn, the more you know how much you don't know. And therefore, you get a little bit of wisdom, even in a passionate guy like me, that says, we'll be fine, we'll be all right. And you know, I think that wine taught me a big thing as well. It's a live product, it changes. It varies, not only during fermentation, maceration, but during aging in a bottle. Just like individuals, we're all different. Well, same with wine, it changes. And you know, going through these phases and going through these sometimes hard time where the wines retract itself and expresses more tannins and acidity than the beautiful silky body that you were looking for at their time and, you know, at the time in their life, is exactly like a human being going through a really tough time in its life because of health reasons, professional reasons, and stuff like that. But hopefully nature makes the wine grows back to its full potential, the same way I think a man has a natural survival instinct to grow back to happiness. And that's what I try to, you know, put into the wine, is that heart, passion, and emotion. And the worst, my worst nightmare is somebody that tastes my wine says, and goes on. I'd rather have somebody look at me and say, I don't like it, because it creates an emotion, good or bad. I've done my job if it creates an emotion. And that's really the philosophy behind it. Yeah, it's kind of scary sometimes, no doubt.
Do you get a chance to hang out with other winemakers here in the Valley?
Yeah, I do, quite often. Last time was last night. We make we custom crush for Domaine Chandon. They're still Pinot Noir program. And so Jim Kress, the winemaker there, was there last night. And for me, it's a huge part of winemaking. I'm not at all the type to protect myself. I'm not at all the type to hide. I'm the opposite. I invite people to criticize me. I invite people to doubt me, because it's gonna make me grow ultimately, you know? And so I created, in addition to having different, you know, friends around the valley and winemakers that come, I actually created a tasting panel. And on that tasting panel, I had European winemaker, American winemakers, distributors, consumers, knowledgeable consumers, and just regular consumers. That I send, every time I make a wine, I send them a paper that always starts by, don't tell me it's good, I don't need to hear that. Tell me what you do not like. And I like that, because wine is not a precise science. Wine comes back to taste, therefore it's subjective. So I would like people to comment. I like the dialogue, I like the exchange. Wine, to start with, is something that is social. So it needs to be an exchange, a debate. You know, I might not like the color of my shirt one day, and you might love it. Wine is exactly that way. And even more intimate, because you actually take it inside of you and consume it. So I think there's an intimacy factor that is quite impressive in wine.
So tell me, what's happened to your voice?
I don't know. I think lack of sleep, probably, and air, and a lot of tasting and stuff like that. During harvest, it's funny, because I usually do not talk a lot. Because once again, it's kind of my privacy, tasting. I do all my tastings in the vineyard early, usually in the morning when I don't have an emergency like today, or when I taste every lot every day. It's always before the workers come in because I need to, you know, tell them what we need to do on different lots. And that for me is the true rapport that I have with the wine and the grape. I mean, everything is calm at 5:30 in the morning. There's not a noise. Even if I worked until 12:30 the night before, and I'm really tired because it has been going on for a couple of weeks or a couple of months, well, you have moods, okay? That's anybody does. And when I come and I start tasting, I mean, my heart and my mood changes. And it just, you, for me, it's liquid poetry. It's just reading a book. It's seeing a movie. It's, you know, contemplating a sculpture. It's and seeing this kind of work shape up to something, to an art piece that you like, hopefully most people do as well, is for me completely amazing. So my voice, I really don't know, maybe because I'm talking too much to you.
I know you had an emergency in one of the vineyards today. Can you tell me what happened?
Well, 2008 is a quite challenging year, but a challenging year for me always says great, because people that understand wine will make the difference. So people that really love what they do will come out bigger and stronger. And the reason why I'm saying this, it started with one of the worst frosts in Napa history. It continued with an early, very early heat spell. Then we had fire and smoke, which were all around the valley with a smoke cover, you know, that was there. Everybody was kind of afraid of the effect it would have on the grape. I didn't think it would be a problem, and so far it hasn't. So, knock on wood. I'm just knocking on my neighbor's head, sorry. And so that was challenging. Then we had rain during flowering, some certain varietal shatter. But all this for me was just nature's way of limiting the yield, reducing the amount of grapes that are out there. When we get closer to harvest, like now, the ripeness is actually a two-phase system. You have the ripeness of sugar, which is the level of sugar that you want to ferment a wine into alcohol to decent levels. But you have the real ripeness, the ripeness of aromas and tannins in reds. And that's the type of ripeness that you want. That's the type of ripeness that you're looking for. Sugar is not so much of a problem. In Napa Valley, you always have enough sugar. We're not in Switzerland, you know, where it starts raining in the middle of August for 5 days in a row, and or could hail and stuff like that. Here, the climate is very, very favorable to great and outstanding wine. So when grapes are getting closer to being picked and being ripened and being fully developed, if you have what we had over the last 10 days and these big spikes of over 100 temperature, your vineyards and your vine react differently. They react to the climatic changes, to this stress, very differently. What happens is usually by then the sugars goes up really very fast. But the aromas and tannins do not follow, meaning you're going to have high sugars, but you're going to have tannins that are still green and edgy, and you're going to have aromas that are not as expressive as they should be. It is to the winemaker to adapt to the condition. And the emergency I had, when I receive a call from one of my vineyard manager that says, "Jean, I'm really stressed. I know you run your samples on your, you know, by yourself and stuff like that, but I just ran a couple of samples and here are where we are. We are 27 bricks. I need to go out right away." Because it's a very fine line between having the exact ripeness and being overripe. Overripe, where you get a little bit more pruny, port type of aromas. You know, underripe, where you would get these tannins and not as much expression. Well, it's a huge, huge issue to find the right balance. And sometimes, very often, it actually does make a difference with 1, 2, or 3 days. And I've seen wines in the past where it did a difference of a 2 day difference with these conditions. So when somebody called me like that, I had to go down, taste that Merlot, you know, make sure that it was where we wanted. And in that particular case, we'll pick it tomorrow and it's gonna come in because I had to go measure. It's like a human, are you gonna marry somebody over the phone? No, You have to see them. You have to feel them. You have to sense them. That's exactly what I did by going down there and tasting it. And I took Chelsea with me because I do for the different partners and the employees a weekly update where I actually write what's going on in the life of the company. And so in order to save me time, Chelsea jumped in my car and actually listened to what I had to say to help me with the grammatical and language side of things of that update. Because as you can hear it during that interview, I'm sure I'm not, English is not my mother tongue. So
your decision was to pick right away.
Yes, yes. Because I went down and I walked these rows and I really thought that if I was going to leave that particular block hanging longer with the wind, right now we don't have high temperatures, all right? But we have wind. Wind accelerates the evapotranspiration of the plant. Therefore, you have a much bigger risk of shriveling grapes. And you don't really want a huge percentage of shrivelage because these are notes that ultimately you want to be one part of the full spectrum, but not an overpowering part. And so I went down there and decided to pick. The last time before that I actually tasted that block was 3 days ago. But you know what? I'm happy that, you know, they start to know and understand what I look and what I want. And the vineyard manager actually calls me to say, hey, just come and take a look. And I do.
That has to give you a great deal of confidence, too.
Yeah, you have to. Anything is not made alone. You know, you can be as passionate and as great as you want to be. I think it's a teamwork, you know, from the pickers to the viticulture to the owners to everybody. Everybody has a role in something. And I think that the difference is very often made in precision. You need people that are dedicated, passionate, because they need to be willing to work and to be precise at something that they love. In this company, you know, it goes from Chelsea, who's our national sales manager, to Eric, who's our hospitality manager, to a lot of different, Henrik, the assistant winemaker. He was with me at Newton, and you know, we moved together because I asked him to come along. Is a guy that never went to school for wine, but knows so much. And these are the type of people I like. I mean, I don't think winemakers are these hotshots at all. I think winemakers, the great winemakers, are the one that can understand to follow their heart, not their book and their studies and all this. And Henrik is definitely one of those. He reacts to his senses, and his senses dictates his decision, and his passion for wine dictates the decision he makes. So it's a pretty cool team.
So what's coming out next for you?
The next vintage coming out after the 2005 you taste is the 06. And the 06 should come out probably by spring of next year. We'll have you taste it for sure. The reason why, it actually was bottled 3 weeks ago. But I like to age my wines in the bottle because one, it gives not only the different components of the wine more time to accept each other and create a synergy, but it also allows the wine to soften itself off the influence of the barrel. You know, barrel for me, it should never be overpowering. Barrel should be, the wood should be one of the many components of a wine. So when I sense and I taste that the wine's ready to come out, it's out. If it's not ready, you know, the market's not ready for it, we'll wait. That's great, but we cannot have it stay in the barrel. So for me, the balance and the personality is important. And at that time I decided, let's take it out. Let's make sure that it softens and accepts each other, you know, itself within the bottle before we release it. And so we'll release the wine when it's ready to be released, when the potential of the personality of the wine is at its peak. That for me is, you know, or at least let's put it this way, at my peak. Am I right? No, I'm not. It's just my peak. And in that particular, you know, model, I make the decision on when to release the wine. And that's why I say, you know, I try to find ways of people to make the wine the way they want. If it's an early wine and we release it in spring and somebody opens that and it's super powerful, I'm going to tell the person, decant it, splash it as a Coke 3 hours before you drink it. And it will hopefully reach what they are looking for into wine. I think the biggest challenge for today's winemaker is to create wine that are drinkable at age zero or at age zero plus 20 years. Because especially on an American market, people want to consume their purchase very, very early. 85% of wine purchased in America are drank within the day. So these are things that you have to know and understand. And I'm not ready to compromise on my philosophy of wine and my quality or the quality I lack of wine. So, you know, the barrel fermentation that you saw is one of the system that allows me to have a wine that is drinkable and soft early, or that could age depending on the profile of, you know, the consumer and what the consumer likes.
How long do you bottle age?
It changes a lot. It changes on profile, you know, and on the bottle shock as well. You know, every single wine will react differently to change of environment. So some wines will go in the bottle shock, and very often with my wines at least, right after bottling, it tastes great in the bottle. But then 3-4 weeks after, that's when you see the suffering of the wine being pushed that hard express itself, because it closes itself. And sometimes takes 2-3 months to open. Sometimes in Bordeaux, I encountered wine that took, 7 years to open from a bottle shock. Is it the bottle shock? Is it the wine? That's another discussion. It's probably a little bit of both. But, you know, it's to be able to understand that wine is something that is alive and that changes, I think allows people to react differently on wine when they drink it. Because if you get to know wine and start a relationship with wine, then you'll understand better what you need to do to get along. I mean, you know, you sometimes have bad surprises as well. I mean, you know, when one of your little babies, you know, have decided not to cooperate or being nice, you have to understand how to read it. And I'll be very honest with you, I had a Chardonnay that was fermenting still a year after. Well, guess what? I tasted. If the aromatic profile was to my liking and it was not affected by off flavors and stuff, let it work. 80% of the wines that I ferment, since they're naturally fermented, stop fermenting at Christmas. Why? Because nature's shutting down. Winter, I'm sorry, do you see blooming and beautiful flowers in the middle of winter? No, it doesn't. Well, yeast reacts exactly the same way, so it stops. So that stresses a lot of people, because I'm going to have to do a starter and re-inoculate. Just let it sit in the barrel. And funny enough, February, March, you see bubbles starting to reappear. Well, guess what? It's spring. Nature starts again. Same in your wine. It's just a question of understanding. I think in an ideal world, what you really want is to put the, if you could, would be to put the grapes directly in the bottle and not to stress them, push them, hit them too hard. So if you look at wine history, wine trends, Bordeaux Primeur program, well, they need to taste the wine early. So they do malolactic in barrel. Why? Because the malolactic, then the wine touches barrel faster, accepts the barrel faster, the wine tastes better. Well, on barrel fermentation, it's exactly the same principle. By putting it on oak right at the beginning, the oak flavors are better integrated, the tannins are better integrated, and the wine is softer. So what I do is take a barrel, take the head up, off the top, put the grapes and skins in there, and actually ferment in there and regulate temperature in there as a smaller container for sure, but also as all these different aromas that will see a relationship or an interaction later in their life anyway, do it early. And so far it works, and we will be tasting as soon as Chelsea decides to finally work. No, I'm just kidding. And bring us some Era, which is the new wine we're coming out in 06. We're coming out with a wine called Era. And it's actually a blend of 35% Cabernet Sauvignon, 35% Merlot, 15% Petit Verdot, and 15% Cabernet Franc. So high percentages of Petit Verdot and Cabernet Franc. And it's 100% barrel fermented. And Chelsea will bring some to us, and you'll tell us if you think I'm right. And this wine was bottled a week ago, but we have a barrel in the tasting room to let people taste. And you'll let me know. And I really think that's the case.
It looks like you punch down the cap, right?
Yes, we do punch downs, yeah. We do punch downs between 5 times a day to 0. And the way we do it is I start a cold maceration at the beginning to extract fruit, because in Napa you have usually higher sugar, therefore higher alcohol. So the fruit extraction for me is very important before the presence of alcohol. And so the more we move within the fermentation, the less I'm going to extract, because the more presence of alcohol will be. Therefore, the more chances of extracting very strong tannins you will have. And I see wine altogether, and especially Napa, as being the best of both worlds. The winemakers need to understand, to me, that we are so lucky to live in a climate in a region like that, which have great climate, great terroir. Well, we have to work on what we don't have. What don't we have? Well, sometimes we miss of elegance, finesse, and acidity, which is, for me, the acidity is the backbone of a wine. Well, we need to be able to work on that. And I think these are things that steps that are that need to be taken in order to reach the perfect wine, or at least my perfect wine. Is it everybody's? Of course not. But that balance between the elegance, the acidity, the extraction, and the ripeness of Napa needs to be reached. And things like the barrel fermentation help doing that, help reaching that balance and that, you know, that hopefully perfect wine.
So Jean, what do you like to drink?
Everything but my own wine, to be very honest with you. I think the worst threat to a winemaker is house taste. I mean, my parents still live in Switzerland. Every single time I go back, my parents, his friends, my uncle, they serve great wines, great Bordeaux, Burgundies, and stuff like that. And they say, just remember, you can always do better. That's all. Yeah, there's always room for improvement. So if I'm satisfied with my own taste, I don't challenge myself. If I don't challenge myself, I can't guarantee people that will end up drinking the wine I make, that it will progress, that it will become better, that there will be an evolution. And I think, you know, once again, I'm not a genius. I'm a guy that loves what he does and that will try to improve every single time. And that's all I guarantee. I'll try to improve. I'll try to make things better. I'll try to listen to comments, opinions, to try to change my own philosophy down the line. So if I'm not here, try to, you know, travel the world and drink wines that challenge aspects that we don't have. Drink Bordeaux, drink Burgundy, higher acidity. Don't forget acidity is very important here. Drink, you know, South American, Australian, good. Different climate, hot climate, you know, new markets, different, very often different price points. Good to challenge yourself as well. I'm a big believer in judging your own work by comparing yourself to others. When I make a wine, I love to have it in the middle of a blind tasting and just challenge the others to see if I'm doing this right or wrong.
John, anything else you'd like to add?
Well, you know, I would just add, come and see us. You know, measure what I think we're at. We have a great view. Hopefully the hospitality is humble. That's what we go through. And we have a very good, open-minded team ready to share taste, share impressions and feelings. And, you know, another great thing, as you saw, is that setting. And to be able at Harvest, you can know you're going to be here until 11 anyways. Sit out on the deck with a glass of wine at the end of the day, take a little breather, go back to work. And that's really what the entire company is about. And I really enjoy that. I mean, it's fun.
Thank you, Jean.
Thank you very much. You know, if you let me talk, I'll talk until tomorrow. So.
You can find Alpha Omega on the web at aowinery.com.